My guest this evening is Barry Wilson. He's a systems ecologist. He is also, according to his bio, he's also a registered professional forester who likes to incorporate Aboriginal traditional knowledge in land use planning. When I saw that, I thought that looks interesting. As a systems ecologist, he aims to improve public policy around sustainability and resilience using comprehensive, holistic, cumulative effects as it applies to integrated land management. And we'll be discussing this very shortly. Barry and his wife Karen operate their own business, CE Analytic Limited. So welcome, Barry, to the core of the matter.
Thank you, Steve.
So listen, you've got to tell me, what is a systems ecologist? Let's start with that.
Systems ecology is a bit of a new science that really takes a look at and examines the interaction of humans and their landscape. Okay. And so systems ecologists try to evaluate, well, I guess look back historically and understand how those interactions have historically taken place and how that's changed or modified what we have today. And then also to use tools and models to look forward into the future and try to understand what might be the different triple bottom line indicators, how they'll perform in the future if we go in different directions. So what will it mean for society? What will it mean for our economy? And what could it mean for our environment?
I looked, I did do a little bit of research, I hope, and I found that one of the things that struck me is when I was an instructor for about 10 years, the systems approach to training, there's that, and then when I saw that, how systems ecologists, a systematic approach, systems approach, and some of the interesting things that you're dealing with, so that you can measure really what's really objectively what's happening. And determine what's going to happen in the future. So a lot of land management planning, land use management?
Yes, for sure. Although more and more we're looking at, the key drivers are more on the people side.
Oh, okay.
And how we use or interact or protect the environment or our landscapes.
Okay. And how people, human beings, interact with that landscape. And how we can measure that. Is that your...
Yeah, that's right. So, it's you can boil it down to being fairly simple and thinking about understanding the cause and effect relationship. So if we, for example, grow our human population, we need a place to live. So then there are alternatives about how we might organize ourselves on our landscape. We might put ourselves in cities that grow in a vertical fashion and stay very compact. Or we may grow those cities very laterally and allow some sprawl and some horizontal growth. We also, a lot of people like to live in acreages or farm residences. And how we disperse ourselves across the landscape, there are different outcomes for all of those aspects, whether it be for a grizzly bear or for a fish, or whether it's for our local economy and our connectedness to our community. So we try to find the relationships or the cause and effect relationships that link different actions to outcomes and describe those in models so people can understand basically the implications of choices that they're making today.
Outcomes, that's an interesting word. And when you talk about bears, so in other words, if we put a mine in here, you could be one of the people that would determine, depending on what kind of a mine it was and what they wanted to do, etc., how that would affect the ecology of, if we asked, let's say, the fish. Let's say it's near a salmon stream or other fish or the other. Is that the type of thing we're talking about?
Kind of,
okay.
Yeah. So, but let me pick up
on
that.
I'm slow. Clue me
in. No, because it's really important. That's a really important distinction. And I've actually just recently written about this because our existing legislative processes around land use decision making are fairly rigorous, fairly narrow, and they focus in on individual projects quite often.
Yes.
So they'll look at, okay, what are the implications? What are the incremental impacts or benefits of a new mine in a watershed? And it's a very rational question to ask, and we do need to answer it. But what I typically do is, first of all, take stand back a little bit and take a look at what's the capacity of the entire watershed to produce a suite of values. And how much of all of those different land uses can we have, and in what form, so that in the future our landscape will resemble what we are reaching for. So if we define our desired future, we can sort of define, well, okay, we'd like to have this kind of water quality, we'd like to have this kind of population density, we'd like to have opportunities for people to earn this many jobs and earn this kind of wages. And so in order to do that, we can basically accommodate a certain amount of land use within the watershed. So there's sort of an umbrella limit. And then what I would like to see done is that mine evaluated, how well does that fit into that future vision? So is that going to contribute to the direction we're going?
So
it's considered in the cumulative perspective rather than individually.
I saw the word holistic.
Yeah.
A holistic approach.
Right.
It seems as though you're going at it actually quite logically and rationally. In other words, you're saying, here's what we'd like in our environment. You want to put a mine there? Let's have a look at this. Instead of, we're going to put a mine there, we want this mine, there's some value, you know. Have you ever heard of Wade Davis? He's a Canadian anthropologist, actually. I think he's still working in the States for National Geographic as their something in residence. Anyway, he talked about how there's been a bit of a controversy around. His name is Wade Davis, W-A-D-E-D-A-V-I-S, I think, Davis. Mm-hmm. And the Sacred Headwaters, that was quite a controversy. And one of the things he tried to say was, you know, some guy in Toronto who happens to have some money and can have an IPO, you know, get some money, and he can build up a coal mine in this Sacred Waters. And I mean, it was a very rhetorical question, but at the same time, I think he was making a very, very strong point that you've just finished elaborating a little bit for me. That's great. You talked a little bit about land use management planning and decision making and the holistic approach. Give me an example just before we go on, because I want to go on to something else BC tomorrow. That sounds really interesting. But can you give me an example of something that you've done recently that correlates with systems ecology?
Well, yes, because that's how I earn my living. I guess maybe one that's really, you know, it's very topical and most people are quite knowledgeable about now, or at least aware of, is the Alberta oil sands.
Yes.
So I worked with a number of colleagues back in, it was 2005 to 2008, a number of different groups, and we got together with 47 stakeholders in the Alberta oil sands region. So that covered the spectrum of First Nations there, Métis, non-governmental organizations, federal government, provincial government, municipalities, local interests, like, you know, the local fishing game and community arts, and pulled all of those perspectives together. We worked through a process for, actually it was 2.5 years, of really using systems ecology to explore what was possible within that oil sands region, the sort of the 10 million hectares in the northeast corner of Alberta. That includes where oil is coming out of, but also includes, you know, all the way up north of Slave Lake and out to the west towards Wood Buffalo National Park. And so examined what was possible over that large landscape over time, recognizing that you can't have, first of all, you can't have all things everywhere all the time.
No.
So there has to be some trade-offs, because some things like boreal caribou, for example, are mutually exclusive with an open pit mine. You can't have the two together in the same space. So in knowing that they're looking for balance, we worked through a process of understanding the connection between, say, oil extraction, forestry, urban growth, natural wildfire, insect and disease outbreaks. We even had looked at some of the initial work around climate change and examined what do we need in order to try to find some reasonable balance where you have areas that are protected in perpetuity for biodiversity.
Yes.
And protecting that gene pool. Also areas where we have sort of a system of management that tries to emulate natural disturbance, and the big one up there is forest management, where it tries to emulate the effects of fire using forest harvesting. And then another zone, which is we sort of call the intensive zone, where they're extracting bitumen. People are living in communities, and this is a major modification, long-term modification of the landscape for human purposes. And so looked at what all of the potential, you know, combinations and options of that are. And then this is the important part, is that when you work with a group of people collaboratively like this, they start to understand each other's position, but also what's possible for the greater good. And inevitably what happens is that innovative solutions emerge from that group about how you can move forward. So they came up with a plan, made 68 recommendations to the Alberta government on how things should be there. And I'm talking big oil is in there as well, with everybody else saying we need to put a cap on how much of the area is being allocated to resource extraction. And inevitably, well, not inevitably, a few years later, after going through a fairly rigorous process, that plan emerged as the Alberta Land Stewardship Act. And they set new policies around protected areas, around the maximum amount of area that could be allocated for industrial use, with a view to trying to find a balance over a large area. Now, I'm not saying it was perfect, and there's still, you know, the implementation of a plan like that can be difficult. But what it does is it gives you that umbrella of what we're all reaching for. And then what we can do is we can put our collective energy into trying to find the individual strategies that will lead us there. But if you don't have that initial view, that strategic vision of where you're going, how can you get there if you're just going one project at a time?
Yeah, I compare it to being to a navigator. You got to know where you are and project into the future if you want to know where you're going. You know, and even it includes where you came from.
That's right.
And what effects you had on you to get where you are.
For sure.
That sounds very interesting from a strictly observer of the tar sands. I wonder how much of the recommendations that you made have been implemented. Now, you did mention that they do have a land use stewardship plan.
Yes. So what they did is they, first of all, made a commitment that wasn't there before, that they would manage the entire region from a cumulative effects perspective, understanding that there's more than a bunch of individual things going on. It's a collective. And then beyond that, they actually have made choices around the amount of area that will be preserved in perpetuity for biodiversity. So they actually, I think it was just a little bit shy of doubling the protected areas within that region.
Oh, that's good. I want to talk about the BC Tomorrow Society, because that's the other thing that Barry is involved in. He's a co-founder and president of the BC Tomorrow Society. It's I'll give you a quick definition, a nonprofit society dedicated to providing leading-edge technology for free to help BC students and teachers explore their own watersheds. And I'm going to let Barry tell me what is the BC Tomorrow Society. Go ahead, Barry.
Thank you, Steve. So the BC Tomorrow Society is a brand new society. We were just incorporated September 2nd. 2014.
Wow, congratulations.
We're only a couple months old.
Yeah.
And the purpose of the society is to help students and teachers better understand sustainable planning. And the way that we intend to do that is by building an online simulator that uses cutting-edge GIS technology to examine land use. And it's kind of like, it's a lot like an Xbox or a PlayStation kind of a game. Or think of Google Earth, where you get onto a computer and you have a landscape and you start working with that landscape.
So this thing is software-driven. It's definitely a...
That's right. But it It's more than a software. We have the simulator sort of at the core, but then around that is extra curriculum that goes to support the teachers and the students. So we have the idea of videos that examine, you know, certain issues, like what does linear edge density mean for a watershed, for example. And ultimately what we'd like to do is see the students actually preparing that material and sharing it with other students in video, in their media. But we'll have that. There'll be lesson plans. There's a website that anybody can access 24/7, and it'll also be an opportunity for bunches of classrooms to share data and collaborate on what they're learning in their watershed.
So how this sounds really interesting for especially for the students. So how close are you to fruition, like putting this thing online, shall we say?
Well, we have a target of trying to have it in SAS, in the secondary school, grade 11 science class. Dave Ramsey is the vice president of the society and co-founder. And he wrote a new class, which we can talk about a little bit later, that tried to look at the incorporation of all these things in a watershed.
Yeah.
And so we intend to pilot the software within his class, and we're hoping that that'll be the fall semester of 2015.
Next fall.
But we have a big hill to climb. We need to
get some money
and put the software together, but that's what we're shooting for.
All right. Well, I hope that there's somebody listening out there that says, hey, that would be a good investment if we're investing in the future, especially in something that is so vital. You know, we're talking about the ecology, the environment. We repeat it ad nauseum, and yet there doesn't seem to be at times anything we can do about it, and yet you want to help the students. They're the ones that will have more of an impact. That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I'd just like to tie back just to one thing we were talking about on the oil sands.
Yes.
Is that with that work, just to be clear, like I wasn't making the recommendations. It was the people that were in the group, the stewardship group, that were making that based on what they learned, right? But this is the same idea that we wrestle now with the decisions that were made there, whether they were the right decisions, because one of the decisions was to continue to produce bitumen, right? And there are many different perspectives. And where I think all of us, just as the general public, haven't had the opportunity to see all of the interactions that they explored, it makes it harder for us to understand how did they come to that decision.
Yeah.
And so the idea with the BC Tomorrow is to help our students start thinking about systems dynamics now while they're learning, so that when they go out in their life, and it doesn't matter really what they're doing, they're citizens in our province and in Canada, and they're faced with having to make these decisions for our, you know, giving guidance to our politicians or voting on a referendum or executing their vote with their wallet, they're going to be much more informed about the implications of the choices that they're making.
So what brought you to this idea? Would it be your experience in the oil sands, in the tar sands?
To put this in the classroom?
Yeah.
Actually, I can't claim credit for it. The actual idea came from a very good colleague of mine, Dr. Brad Stelfox, in Alberta.
Oh.
And Dr. Stelfox is the founder of the ALCES model, which is an acronym that stands for Landscape Cumulative Effects Simulator, and I work with that. And I actually first met Dr. Stelfox at a UN conference back in 2000, and been very fortunate to work with him and his group for some 14 years now. And Brad's vision was, you know, we were doing this kind of work, and he wanted it in the hands of youth. So they actually made this happen in Alberta. So there is a site called Alberta Tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
And it's been active and in the schools now for about 3 years.
So somebody listening could go to that site, just
albertatomorrow.ca.
.ca.
Yes, and there is a public sign-up, so you just need to give your email, and you can go in and play with what they have.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah.
So that answers my next question, because is there a model somewhere else? Has it been tried elsewhere? And it's this Dr. Stelfox in Alberta.
Yeah, that's right. So, but the interesting thing is that, so I've been doing this kind of work, you know, for my job, and I've always had an interest in education. I was a former director of the BC Forestry Association. We were talking earlier, I was president of the Greater Victoria Community Forest Society. And so I've always had this interest, and as a forester, also taking kids out on National Forestry Week and trying to teach them about ecology. Because the innovation and the solutions that come from young minds thinking about these that aren't, they're not worn down and carrying all the baggage that we have of life and experience. They've got a fresh view. They often coming up with the solutions for the future. And so it's exciting to empower them with that.
Yeah, and they seem to be able to naturally think outside the box.
They do.
That box that we're boxed in with.
Yeah.
They seem to have an imagination that is really quite powerful. So,
So a little bit further along the lines of that, I read an article 2 years ago in The Observer. Barb Brower put an interview together with Dave Ramsey.
Oh.
And it talked about this course that he had written as part of his master's thesis. And he was looking at integrating the environment and civics.
Ah.
And trying to bridge that gap within the school. So, of course, I read that and I was pretty stoked about it. Got a hold of Dave. I went up to his classroom. And we compared notes and PowerPoint presentations and found out we were both on the same track. And then I said, hey, you're an educator, and you're already thinking the way I'm thinking. I have colleagues that have put this together in Alberta. Why don't we make this happen in BC?
Fabulous. So can you sum up how, now I know this sounds as though I'm duplicating something, but how this specifically helps the students? It gives them the tools. Go ahead and.
Okay, well, it's a technologically pretty snazzy tool, so it's exciting. And so the first thing is that I think students will enjoy working with it. I think we've all played with Google Earth. This simulator actually gives you the ability to zoom in and zoom out on your own watershed, to be able to designate, build your own plan and designate areas that are going to have different activities and stuff like that. So they'll be able to interact with that in a medium that youth and students are super comfortable with now. It's on the internet, and they can, go home, show their parents. So that's one thing, as I think it'll be really interesting and exciting for them to use. Secondly, we hope that this whole offering will be free of charge. So we'll be looking for long-term donations. In Alberta, they've been able to maintain it with some corporate sponsorship. And we'd like to see this grow throughout the entire province. We'll start here in the Shoe Swamp, but we'd like to see it available for everybody in British Columbia and all students for sure. And another thing is that we can connect different, pillars of study within the school together. So the social studies teacher can work in parallel or together with the science teacher. And hopefully the kids will start to see that interaction right in their classes and start to think in that holistic way. So this software forces you to think about not only, what are environmental values, but how are we going to live? What's our quality of life going to be? How much money can we earn from different jobs? It's not just about footprint, but it's, about the economic side and those key components as well. So we know that, for example, tourism is a very valuable sector in our region, and it contributes in a significant way to local employment and providing a lot of opportunities. And it also gives a lot of people from outside of the Shoe Swap an opportunity to enjoy it. But we also know that it has some liability. So together, just footprint as an example, or the amount of people that come and spend their time on our lake in the summer.
Exactly. Water quality. How is water quality affected?
So they'll be able to look at that. And I think ultimately the big benefit will be that students will start to, I hope, feel really empowered about driving good ideas into their watershed and into their community. And maybe they'll talk to, become more active in their local politics and maybe become entrepreneurs and find new businesses that support their watershed in a good way. I'm hoping that this will stimulate some of that thinking.
Well, I have no doubt, especially the students of today. One of the questions that I got on an email is, what impact is this having? Maybe you can talk about the students, or how is this going to change things? Can you tell me?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. I'll give two examples. One, first I'll start with just the perception from Dave Ramsey's perspective, is that, you know, in putting together this course that sort of integrates a number of different disciplines, what he's found is that the tools that are available for him to do that are few and far between. So this is a tool that will, I think, help teachers bring that perspective easily to the students. From the students' perspective, if you go to albertatomorrow.ca, you'll see some videos on there that show interviews actually with students. And in particular, one that I show when we do presentations is grade four students.
Grade four, nine-year-olds.
And they are talking like a bunch of high-end systems ecologists after about a day. It's really impressive. And I guess the thing is that, as we talked about at the beginning, they see the connections very easily. They see the world as a group of things that are all happening simultaneously. They've not narrowed their view to just see things in silos.
So they have a holistic view.
Yes, and so they get it right away. And right away, then, their minds are generating all kinds of ideas about solutions or about how much they want. In fact, there's one girl in that grade four class that's saying, you know, we need to have cities and we need to have oil factories, but I only want this many. Because I also want these other things around for me.
Interesting. So, and this is grade four.
That's right. They're connecting the dots. Another young boy talks about the fact that he never really thought much about litter, and that, you know, all he would do is point it out to other people. But now he understands a little bit better the implications of that, so he actually acts on it and picks it up.
Very interesting, too. Well, you know, based just on the technology they have around them, especially the cell phone and these smartphones, etc., kids are so quick today. Mm-hmm. The answers, they want the answers, they want the information quickly, and they'll make decisions very quickly.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes I'm always amazed when I talk to them. They always blow me away. You know, you think these kids aren't thinking about this stuff, but they are.
They are. They absolutely are. And that's one of the cool things, too, about this technology is that, you know, if you look at Alberta Tomorrow, you will see a set of indicators that they've chosen that are relevant for them. What we hope to do is build indicators that are relevant and important for our watershed. So it'll be very localized. But basically what they do is they go in and they choose a mission. So they may have four or five different goals on there, and they set targets for themselves. Okay, I'm going to try to achieve this much in water quality. I'm going to try to achieve this much in terms of jobs. I'm going to try to achieve whatever it is, this value in air quality or local food security or whatever the indicator is going to be. And then they set out, they choose a location, so they define their area of study, whether it's the whole watershed or something smaller. And they start to make an hypothesis. Okay, well, if we did this much and this much activity here, there, and everywhere around our study area, I think it will result in me achieving my goals, and they get to test it then. So that's what the simulator does. It runs it, and it says, well, here's how well you did. And so they work iteratively with that tool and basically do a land use assessment of their study area. So they're learning, you know, cause and effect. And then what they can do is come up, what Dave is working with me on is being able to then integrate that with a field experiment. So I have an idea about this watershed. Now I've got to do something in my own watershed. And let's say I want to go and actually measure some water in the Salmon River. So they can go down there on a field trip, have that opportunity to be live in the environment and interacting, taking samples. And, you know, using their cell phones, which most of them are going to have anyways, take photographs, record data, instantaneously upload it to their report on their website, share that with all the other students, press a button and produce a summary report and put their findings there. So there, it's not a whole bunch of effort in the mechanics. It's more time spent trying and learning.
Yeah, trying something and see just what effect that has. Right. Well, you might want to start with the White Lake watershed. I just moved from White Lake into Salmon Arm, and I know that they're logging in the watershed. Now, there was some controversy around it, but then, you know, they seem to be taking care not to, first of all, they can't come too close to the lake. But it would be interesting to see whether, I don't know how much water comes into that lake underground. Because there's only one creek, basically, that flows into it. Anyway, that's another story. Let me ask you: is it strictly for the students, or when the website's up, the public can use it too?
Yeah, absolutely. They've had different sign-ins so that they can discern between the general public and students. So the software then, if you sign in as a student, you're given like a student ID by your teacher. And so then the teacher can see all of the students in the class and see their information, and that can be kept private, you know, so just within the class. But there is another portal to sign in as the public and to try this out yourself. I think one of the key pieces too that, and the example from White Lake is an important one, is that it's really crucial that this not be seen as pushing an agenda or you know, trying to influence our youth to one direction or the other. What we're trying to do is give them tools and skills to think critically for themselves. So a key piece of this will be to assemble what we're calling a technical advisory committee that will be a part of the BC Tomorrow Society, and it will be made up of experts or people of knowledge in the different sectors that this simulator is representing. So, you know, you mentioned forestry and water quality. So, you know, there are some coefficients in the literature that would suggest a certain kind of forest is either clear-cut or selectively harvested. You're going to have different rates of phosphorus offloading off of that site that go into the watershed. And what we want to do is have all of that, those coefficients and those relationships, vetted by local people in our community. So,
experts.
Yeah, so that we have a lot of local input on it, and we also feel comfortable that we're getting a balanced perspective and that somebody's not trying to push the facts one way or another to prove a point.
No, it's more objective.
That's right. And also, the model is, it's fairly simple and so, you know, not particularly dangerous. It's the idea is to be able to learn about cause and effect and system dynamics and get people thinking, but not build land use plans with it.
No, that has to be that's an arm of government, or it has a specific but they could possibly have an input, or the land use management may come to them and say, listen, give us an idea what would happen here.
Right. Or, you know, that's the kind of work that I work on with either, you know, could be groups like the Shuswap Watershed Council that's forming, or other organizations that build very complex models to look at the complex interaction of everything, and you do actually use it for input and planning.
Yeah. I'm sure that SEAS, who just is celebrating their 25th anniversary, mm-hmm. you know all about SEAS, I'm sure they'd be very interested in this. You've seen the map they did of the Shuswap watershed.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, Jim Cooperman has already posted two sources of data on the Facebook page for BC Tomorrow already of things around climate change that he thought would be valuable to contribute. So.
Well, I read that book, and he's definitely somebody who's really involved, and I'm mm-hmm. glad to hear that already there's... Well, let's talk about other people now. You know, Jim's a good contact because I'm sure he knows some people who would answer this next question. How can people get involved and support this initiative? And you talked about funding, of course. As funding is always an issue. And do you have any ideas about some of the ways that, or some of the people that might, what about a forest company? Do you think they might want to provide some funding?
Well, I hope so. I think... You know, getting involved, we're looking at a few different levels, and as I mentioned, we're only 2 months into it. We've had two board meetings, and we're just figuring out what the ultimate composition of the board and its size will be. And then we're also looking at this technical advisory committee and who the members of that would be, and also looking at maybe drawing on some energy out of the community for public relations and utilizing social media, sharing the vision around our community, because we certainly can't do it all ourselves. There's going to be sort of that grassroots input into this from our community that way. We're also potentially looking at some membership, although membership is probably more of a funding piece than anything else to help keep it going. But we've seen the model work very well in Alberta with about 10 corporate sponsors. And then we're also examining the opportunity to register with 1% for the Planet as a means to obtain funding. They support projects and initiatives like this. I know the BC Real Estate Foundation is a potential group. They've certainly sponsored Alberta Tomorrow in Alberta. You know, it could be other initiatives around town where we talked earlier about Dan McCrory and the McCrory Institute.
Yeah. Would you please tell me a little bit about the McCrory Lecture Series? I know Dan McCrory. I love the man.
Yes. Well, Dan actually got in touch with me through Jim Barmby. Jim Barmby is the dean of Okanagan College. And Jim became aware of what I was doing in the summer at a presentation I provided downtown for the Plan BDE group. And it sort of followed up from there. And Dan McCrory is my best way to describe it, a local philanthropist.
Yes.
He is a former minister.
United
years.
Church minister, I think. So. Yeah, and he was a counselor here. He's just
That's right.
He just doesn't give up.
He's very active and has a real passion for seeing a fair Canada.
Yes.
And seeing our communities move forward sustainably and responsibly. And he's very interested in making opportunities for people to learn about, initiatives or ideas that move in that direction. And so I was approached by Jim and Dan to speak in the McCrory Lecture Series. And we're going to go ahead with that. It looks like it's going to be February 4th in the Salmar. I think that date has been nailed down. And if not, I apologize, but that's sort of what we're targeting.
Don't worry. This station, that's part of our mandate, our raison d'être, is to make sure it gets out there. And aside from this program and other, we have, as you may know, every day, every weekday at noon and at 6 o'clock at night, events calendar by Leah Shaw.
Right.
And definitely it would be on there, especially if she gets the information and we'll send it to her.
Right. And so Dan asked me, or has invited me to speak about, I guess, two things. One is sort of systems ecology and the greater concept that we started with tonight.
Yes.
And then I wanted to have Dave Ramsey join me for the latter half of that discussion, and we'll talk about BC Tomorrow and where we're taking it in this community. And hopefully it's going to be exciting, enjoyable. If with any luck at all, we can have a live demonstration of the model just sort of, you know, get more and more people aware, and it may also be an opportunity for people to contribute.
I want you to go to your calendar now, and you, the listener out there, go to your calendar and put, at least in pencil, put in February the 4th, McCrory, or you can put Barry Wilson's name there, Barry Wilson and Dave Ramsey, lecture series, or lecture, and then Salmar, hopefully that'll well be the date, February the 4th. Of 2015. We are running out of time, but there's one quick question I have. Let's see, what do I got? A couple of minutes. Could you apply this model to some of these pipelines as an example? Like, let's take the Trans Mountain Pipeline. Could you take your model and apply it to that?
You could, yes.
Okay. So that sounds very interesting, and it would be more objective and, of course, then there's the Site C. There's another interesting, a bit of a controversy.
Yeah, so Yeah, and I think this underlines, you know, without getting into the details of any individual one of those, because they are very important, and this is precisely where these tools become very valuable, I think, for planners and decision makers. But without getting into the details of any one of those issues, it's a really good example of how the public is now faced with making decisions that it's very hard to wrap our minds around. We're not fully informed about the consequences of all of the implications, and so we have to rely on media reports and in my opinion, the environmental review process is a little bit narrow. You know, it's confined by a 2-year process, and I just sort of describe at the end of that is like the sword of Damocles hanging over your head. A decision will be made whether or not.
The decision is already made. It's all about mitigation and trying to, as they say, grease the skids so that it fits into place. And unfortunately, I think the public has this idea that the decision isn't made yet. We got to do an environmental assessment. Anyway, I hear what you're saying. What else did I want to...
Just moving forward, maybe?
Yes. Oh, yes. Please, tell me about that.
So we've got, I guess, 3 key priorities figured out moving forward for the BC Tomorrow Society. One is the most important for us is to obtain our nonprofit status with Revenue Canada. So once we have that in place, then we will be able to receive donations, which will be vital in getting the software developed and in place and in the school.
So, just to be precise, I think really what you're talking about is a charitable status.
That's right.
Where you're definitely already a nonprofit, but a charitable status, we didn't go that. Okay, the next one?
So that's a big priority. The second is community communications. So, you know, utilizing social media, doing live presentations, getting out and doing interviews like we're doing tonight. And we're potentially looking at a newsletter or a blog or something like that, because the whole idea here is to make sure that we have an opportunity to draw the community into this. We'd rather see this be a community initiative, and we just got the ball rolling. And then our third is, of course, we've got to build our simulator and get it into the classroom and let the teacher and the students start test driving it.
I love simulators. Hey, we're going to have to end it there, Barry. Thank you very much for coming. It's been interesting. We're going to have to do some more of this.